Chapter 10. The army major, thin, small, and erect, said,
Frau Thibodeau, this is the Reichsmarschall, Herr Hermann Göring.
The heavy-built man, wearing, incredibly, a toga-style white robe and holding on a leather leash what appeared to be a lion cub, stepped forward and said in German,
I am glad to meet you, Mrs. Thibodeau.
Reichsmarschall, Nicole said, do you know where you are at this moment?
Yes, Göring nodded.
To the lion cub he said severely,
Sie ruhig, Massi.
He fussed with the cub, calming it. All this Berthold Goltz watched. He had gone slightly ahead in time by use of his own von Lessinger equipment. He had become impatient waiting for Nicole to arrange the transfer of Göring. Here it was now, or rather, here it would be in 7 more hours. It was easy, possessing von Lessinger equipment, to penetrate the White House despite its NP guards. Goltz had merely gone far back into the past, before the White House existed, and then had returned to this near future. He had done such a thing several times already and would do it again. He knew that because he had run onto his future self, caught in the act. It amused him, that meeting. Not only was he able to observe Nicole freely, but he could also observe his past and future selves. The future, at least, in terms of possibility, of potentiality rather than actuality. The vistas spread out for his inspection of the perhaps. They will make a deal, Goltz decided. Nicole and Göring, the Reichsmarschall taken first from 1941 and then from 1944, will be shown the ruined Germany of 1945. We'll see the end in store for the Nazis. We'll see himself in the dock at Nuremberg. And, at last, will view his own suicide by a poison carried in a rectal suppository. This will rather influence him, to say the least. A deal will not be difficult to hatch out. The Nazis, even normally, were experts at deals. A few miracle weapons from the future, appearing at the end of World War II, and the age of barbarism would last not 13 years, but as Hitler had sworn, 1,000. A death ray, laser beams, hydrogen bombs in the 100 megaton range. It would assist the armed forces of the Third Reich considerably. Plus, of course, the A1 and the A2, or as the Allies had called them, the V1 and V2. Now the Nazis would have an A3, A4, and so on without limit, if necessary. Goltz frowned, for, in addition to this, other possibilities, murky and dense, spread out parallel with an almost occult darkness surrounding them. What did these less likely futures consist of? Dangerous, and yet surely better than the clear one, the track laden with miracle weapons.
You there!
A White House NP man called, suddenly catching sight of Goltz as he stood partially concealed in the corner of the bog orchid room. The guard instantly whipped out a pistol and took aim. The conference between Nicole Thibodeau, Göring, and 4 military advisors abruptly terminated. All turned toward Goltz and the NP man.
Frau,
Goltz said, a parody of Göring's greeting. He stepped forth, confidently. After all, he previewed this with his von Lessinger gear. You know who I am, the specter at the feast, he chuckled. But of course, the White House possessed von Lessinger equipment, too. They had anticipated this, just as he had. This exposure had in it the element of fatality. It could not be avoided. No alternate tracks branch off here. Not that Goltz wished for them. Long ago he had learned that ultimately there was no future for him in anonymity.
Some other time, Goltz, Nicole said with distaste.
Now, Goltz said, walking toward her. The NP man glanced at her for instructions. He appeared highly confused. Nicole waved him away irritably.
"Who is this?"
the Reichsmarschall inquired, studying Goltz. Goltz said, "Just a poor Jew. Not like Emil Stock, whom I notice is not here, Nicole, despite your promise. There are many poor Jews, Reichsmarschall, in your time and ours, both. I have nothing of cultural or economic value which you can confiscate. No artwork, no geld. Sorry." He seated himself at the conference table and poured a glass of ice water from the pitcher at hand. "Is your pet, Marcy, feral? Ja oder nein?" "No," Goering said, petting the cub expertly. He had sat down, placed the cub on the table before him. It curled up obediently, its eyes half closed. "My presence," Goltz said, "my Jewish presence, is unwanted. I wonder why Emil Stark isn't here." "Why not, Nicole?" He eyed her. "Did you fear to offend the Reichsmarschall?" "Strange, after all. Himmler dealt with Jews in Hungary through Eichmann, and there is a Jewish general in the Reichsmarschall's Luftwaffe, a certain General Milch." "True, Herr Reichsmarschall?" He turned to Goering. Looking peeved, Goering said, "I wouldn't know about Milch. He's a good man. I can say that much." "You see," Bertolt Gold said to Nicole, "Herr Goering is accustomed to dealing with Juden. Right, Herr Goering?" "You don't have to answer. I've observed it for myself." Goering glared at him sourly. "Now, this deal," Goltz began. "Bertolt," Nicole interrupted savagely, "get out of here. I've let your street fighters roam at will. I'll have them rounded up if you interfere with this. You know what my objective is here. You, of all people, ought to approve." "But I don't," one of the army advisors snapped. "Why not?" "Because," Goltz said, "once the Nazis have won World War II by your aid, they will massacre the Jews anyhow. And not just those in Europe and White Russia, but in England and the United States and Latin America as well." He spoke calmly. After all, he had seen it, had explored, by means of his von Lessinger equipment, several of these dreadful alternate futures. "Remember, the objective in the war for the Nazis was the extermination of world Jewry. It was not merely a byproduct." There was silence. To the NP man, Nicole said,
"Get him now."
The NP man, pointing his gun, fired at Goltz. Goltz, timing it perfectly, at the same instant the gun was pointed at him, made contact with the von Lessinger effect surrounding him. The scene, with its participants, blurred and was lost. He remained in the same room, the bog orchid, but the people were gone. He was alone, yet now in the midst of the elusive ghosts of the future summoned by the device. He saw, in deranged procession, the psychokinetic Richardson Groshen involved in weird situations, first with his rituals of cleansing, and then with Wilder Pembroke. The commissioner of the NP had done something, but Goltz could not make out what. And then he saw himself, first holding vast authority, and then, abruptly, unaccountably, dead. Nicole, too, drifted past his range of vision, altered in various new ways which he could not comprehend. Death seemed to exist everywhere in the future, a potential awaiting everyone, it seemed. What did this signify? An hallucinosis? The collapse of certitude appeared to lead directly to Richardson Groshen. It was an effect of the psychokinetic power, a distortion of the fabric of the future produced by the man's parapsychological talent. If Groshen knew, Goltz thought, strength of this sort, a mystery even to the owner. Groshen, tangled in the maze of his mental illness, virtually unable to function, and yet still imposing, still looming vastly on the landscape of the tomorrows, of our days ahead. If I could only penetrate this, Gulch realized, this man who is, will become the cardinal enigma for all of us, then I would have it. The future would no longer consist of imperfect shades blended in configurations which customary reason, mine anyhow, can never manage to untangle. In his room at Franklin Ames Neuropsychiatric Hospital, Richard Congrotion declared aloud, "I am totally invisible now." He held up his hand and arm, saw nothing.
"It's come,"
he added, and he did not hear his voice. That, too, was imperceptible.
"What should I do now?"
he asked the four walls of his room. There was no response. Congrotion was completely alone. He no longer had any contact with other life.
"I've got to get out of here," he decided. "Seek help. I'm not getting any help here. They've been unable to arrest the illness process. I'll go back to Jenner. See my son."
There was no point in seeking out Dr. Superb, or any other medical man, chemically oriented or not. The period of seeking therapy was over, and now a new period. What did it consist of? He did not know yet. In time he would know, however, assuming that he lived through it. And how could he do that when, for all intents, he was already dead?
"That's it," he said to himself. "I have died, and yet I'm still alive." It was a mystery. He did not understand it. "Perhaps," he thought, "what I must seek then is rebirth." Effortlessly, after all, no one could see him, he made his way from his room and down the corridor to the stairs, down the stairs and out the side entrance of Franklin Ames Hospital. Presently, he was walking along the sidewalk of an unfamiliar street, somewhere in a hilly section of San Francisco, surrounded by vastly high apartment buildings, many of them dating from before World War III. By avoiding stepping on any cracks of the cement pavement, he canceled, for the time being, the trail of noxious odor which otherwise he would have left in his wake. "I must be getting better," he decided. "I found at least a temporary ritual of purification to balance my phobic body odor."
And except for the fact that he was still invisible,
"How am I going to play the piano this way?" he asked himself. "This means, evidently, the end of my career."
And then all at once, he remembered Merrill Judd, the chemist with A.G. Chemie.
"Judd was supposed to be going to help me," he recalled. "I completely forgot about it in the excitement of becoming invisible. I can go by autocab to A.G. Chemie."
He hailed an autocab which was passing. It failed to see him. Disappointed, he watched it go by.
"I thought I was still visible to purely electronic scanning devices," he thought. "Evidently not, however." "Can I walk to an A.G. Chemie branch?" he asked himself. "I guess I'll have to, because of course I can't board the ordinary pub trans. It wouldn't be fair to the others." "I've got quite a task for Judd," he realized. "Not only must the man eradicate my phobic body odor, but he has to make me visible once more."
Discouragement filled Congrotion's mind.
"They can't do it," he realized. "It's too much. It's hopeless. I'll just have to keep on trying for rebirth. When I see Judd, I'll ask him about it, see what A.G. Chemie can do for me in that line. After all, next to CARP, they're the most powerful economic syndrome in the entire USEA. I'd have to go back to the USSR to find a greater economic entity. A.G. Chemie is so proud of its chemical therapy,
Let's see if they have a drug which promotes rebirth.
He was walking along, thinking those thoughts while avoiding stepping on the cracks in the pavement, when all at once he realized that something lay in his path. An animal, flat, platter-shaped, orange with black spots, its antennae waving. And at the same instant, a thought formed in his brain.
Rebirth. Yes, a new life. Begin over on another world. Mars.
Kongroshin halted and said,
You're right.
It was a papoula there on the sidewalk before him. He looked around and saw, sure enough, a jalopy jungle parked not far off, the shiny jalopies sparkling in the sunlight. There, in the center of the lot, in a little office building, sat the operator of the lot, and Kongroshin moved step by step toward him. The papoula followed, and as it followed, it communicated with him.
Forget A.G. Kemi. They can't do anything for you.
Right, Kongroshin thought. It's entirely too late for that. If Judd had come up with something right away, it would have been different, but now.
And then he realized something.
The papoula could see him.
Or at least it could sense him with some organ of apperception in some dimension or other, and it did not object to his smell.
Not at all, the papoula was telling him. You smell perfectly wonderful to me. I have no complaints at all. Absolutely none.
Kongroshin, halting, said,
Would it be that way on Mars? They could see me, or at least perceive me, and I wouldn't offend them?
There are no Theodore Snitz commercials on Mars,
the papoula's thoughts came to him, forming in his eager mind.
You will gradually shed your contamination there, in that pure, virgin environment. Enter the office, Mr. Kongroshin, and speak to Mr. Miller, our sales representative. He is eager to serve you. He exists to serve you.
Yes, Kongroshin said,
and opened the door of the office. There was, ahead of him, another customer waiting. The salesman was filling out a contract form. A thin, tall, balding customer who looked ill at ease and restless. He glanced toward Kongroshin and then moved a step away. The smell had offended him.
Forgive me, Kongroshin mumbled in reply.
Now, Mr. Strikerock, the salesman was saying to this previous customer, if you'll sign here.
He turned the form around and held up a fountain pen. The customer, in a spasm of muscular activity, signed, then stepped back, visibly shaking from the tension.
It's a big moment, he said to Kongroshin. When you decide to do this, I'd never have had the courage on my own, but my psychiatrist suggested it, said it was the best alternative for me.
Who's your psychiatrist?
Kongroshin said, naturally interested.
Well, there's only one. These days, Dr. Egon Superb.
He's mine too, Kongroshin exclaimed. A darn good man. I was just talking to him.
The customer now studied Kongroshin's face intently. He said then, very painstakingly and slowly,
You're the man on the telephone. You called Dr. Superb. I was in his office.
The salesman for the Jalopy Jungle spoke up. Mr. Strikerock, if you want to step outside with me, I'll go over the handling instructions with you, just to be on the safe side. And you can pick out whichever jalopy you want. To Kongroshin, he said, I'll be able to help you in just a moment. Please be patient, if you will. Kongroshin stammered,
Can you see me?
I can see everybody, the salesman said,
given time enough.
And he left the office with Strikerock then.
Calm yourself, the papoula said within Kongroshin's mind.
It had remained in the office, evidently to keep him company.
All is well. Mr. Miller will take good care of you, and very
very soon. It crooned to him, lulling him. All is well, it intoned. Suddenly the customer, Mr. Strikerock, re-entered the office. To Congrosion, he said,
Now I remember who you are. You're the famous concert pianist who's always playing for Nicole at the White House. You're Richard Congrosion.
Yes, Congrosion admitted, pleased to be recognized. Just to be on the safe side, however, he moved carefully back from Strikerock so as not to offend him.
I'm amazed, he said, that you can see me. Just recently, I've become invisible. In fact, that's what I was discussing with Egon Superb on the phone. Currently, I'm seeking rebirth. That's why I'm going to emigrate. There's no hope for me here on Earth, obviously.
I know how you feel, Strikerock said, nodding. Just recently, I quit my job. I've got no ties to anyone here anymore, not to my brother, nor to... He paused, his face dark. To anyone. I'm leaving alone with no one.
Listen, Congrosion said on impulse. Why don't we emigrate together? Or does my phobic body odor offend you too much?
Strikerock did not seem to know what he meant.
Emigrate together? You mean go in for a land stake as partners?
I have plenty of money, Congrosion said, from my concert appearances. I can finance both of us easily.
Money was certainly the least of his worries, and maybe he could help this Mr. Strikerock, who, after all, had just quit his job.
Maybe we could work something out, Strikerock said thoughtfully, nodding slowly up and down. It's going to be lonely as hell on Mars. We wouldn't have any neighbors except perhaps simulacra, and I've seen enough of them as it is to last me the rest of my life.
The salesman, Mr. Miller, returned to the office looking a trifle perturbed.
We need only one jalopy between us, Strikerock said to him. Congrosion and I are emigrating together, as partners.
Shrugging philosophically, Mr. Miller said, I'll show you two a slightly larger model then, a family-sized model. He held the door of the office open, and Congrosion and Chick Strikerock stepped out onto the lot.
You two know each other? Not before now, Strikerock said. But we both have the same problem. We're invisible here on Earth, so to speak.
That's right, Congrosion put in. I've become totally invisible to the human eye. Obviously, it's time to emigrate.
Yes, if that's the case, I would say so,
Mr. Miller agreed tartly. The man on the telephone said, My name is Merrill Judd of A.G. Chemie. I'm sorry to bother you.
Go ahead,
Janet Raynor said, seating herself at her neat, small, idiosyncratically arranged desk. She nodded to her secretary, who at once shut the office door, cutting out the noises from the White House corridor outside.
You say this has to do with Richard Congrosion?
That's right.
On the screen, Merrill Judd's miniature face image nodded.
And for that reason, it occurred to me to contact you, because of the close ties between Congrosion and the White House. It seemed reasonable to me that you'd want to know.
I tried, about half an hour ago, to visit Congrosion at Franklin Ames Neuropsychiatric Hospital in San Francisco. He was gone. The staff there couldn't locate him.
I see,
Janet Raynor said.
Evidently, he's quite ill. From what he said to me,
yes, Janet said, he's quite ill. Do you have any other information for us? If not, I'd like to get started on this right away.
The A.G. Chemie psych chemist had no other information. He rang off, and Janet dialed an inside line, trying several White House stations until at last she managed to reach her nominal superior, Harold Slezak.
Congrosion has left the hospital and vanished. God knows where he may have gone, possibly back to Jenner. We should check that, of course. Frankly, I think the NP should be brought in. Congrosion is vital.
Vital,
Slezak echoed, wrinkling his nose.
Well,
let's say, rather, that we like him. We'd prefer not to have to make do without him. I'll obtain Nicole's permission to involve the police. I think you're right in your estimate of the situation. Slezak, with no amenities, rang off then. Janet hung up the phone. She had done all she could do. It was now out of her hands. The next thing she knew, an NP man was in her office, notebook in hand. Wilder Pembroke. She had run into him many times when he had held lesser positions, seated himself across from her, and began to take notes.
"I've already checked with Franklin Ames." The NP commissioner regarded her thoughtfully. "It seems that Congrotion made a phone call to Dr. Egon Superb. You know who he is, the sole remaining psychoanalyst? He left not much after that. To your knowledge, was Congrotion seeing Superb?"
"Yes, of course," Janet said, "for some time."
"Where do you think he would go?"
"Except for Jenner, he's not there. We've got somebody in the area now." "Then I don't know. Ask Superb."
"We're doing that," Pembroke said.
She laughed. "Maybe he's joined Berthold Goltz."
The commissioner, not amused, his flat face hard, said, "We'll look into that, of course. And there's always the possibility he ran into one of those Looney Luke lots, those fly-by-night jalopy jungles. They seem somehow to show up at the appropriate time and place. God knows how they manage it, but they do, somehow. Of all the possibilities..." Pembroke was speaking half to himself. He seemed quite agitated. "As far as I'm concerned, that's the very worst."
"Congrotion would never go to Mars," Janet said. "There's no market for his talents there. They don't need concert pianists. And underneath his eccentric artistic exterior, Richard is shrewd. He would be aware of that."
"Maybe he's given up playing," Pembroke said, "for something better."
"I wonder what sort of farmer a psychokinetic would make."
Pembroke said, "Maybe that's exactly what Congrotion is wondering at this moment, too."
"I would think he'd want to take his wife and son."
"Perhaps not. Maybe that's the entire point. Have you seen the boy, the offspring? Do you know about the Jenner area and what's happened there?"
"Yes," she said tightly.
"Then you understand." They were both silent.
Ian Duncan was just seating himself in the comfortable, leather-covered chair across from Dr. Egon Superb when the squad of NP men burst into the office. "You'll have to disperse your healing a little later," the young, sharp-chinned NP squad leader said as he briefly showed Dr. Superb his credentials. "Richard Congrotion has disappeared from Franklin Ames and we are trying to locate him. Has he contacted you?"
Not since leaving the hospital," Dr. Superb said.
"He called me earlier, while he was still..."
"We know about that,"
the NP man eyed Superb. "What do you think are the chances that Congrotion has joined the Sons of Job?" Superb said at once, "None whatsoever."
"All right,"
the NP man noted that.
"In your opinion, is there any chance he might have approached the Looney Luke people? Emigrated? Or be attempting to emigrate by means of a jalopy?"
After a long pause, Dr. Superb said,
"I think the chances are excellent. He seeks perpetually isolation."
The NP leader closed his notebook, turned to his squad, and said,
"Then that's it. The lots will have to be closed."
Into his portable comm system, he said,
"Dr. Superb concurs with the lot idea, but not with the Sons of Job. I think we should go along with him. The doctor seems to be certain. Check at once in the San Francisco area, see if a lot has shown up there. Thanks."
He rang off, then said to Dr. Superb, "We appreciate your help. If he does contact you, notify us." He laid his card on Dr. Superb's desk.
"Don't be rough on him," Dr. Superb said. "If you do find him, he's very, very ill."
The NP man glanced at him, smiled slightly,
and then the squad of them left the office, the door shut after them. Ian Duncan and Dr. Superb were again alone. In a peculiar, hoarse voice, Ian Duncan said,
"I'll have to consult with you some other time."
He rose unsteadily to his feet.
"Goodbye."
"What's wrong?" Dr. Superb said, also rising.
"I've got to go."
Ian Duncan plucked at the door, managed to open it, disappeared. The door slammed. Strange, Dr. Superb thought. The man, Duncan, was it? Didn't even have an opportunity to begin discussing his problem with me. Why did the appearance of the NP upset him so? Pondering, but finding no answer, Dr. Superb reseated himself and buzzed Amanda Connors to send in the next patient. A whole waiting room full of them waited outside. The men, all surreptitiously, and many of the women, too, watching Amanda and every move she made.
"Yes, doctor,"
Amanda's sweet voice came, cheering up Dr. Superb more than a little. As soon as he was out of the doctor's office, Ian Duncan searched frantically for an auto cab. Al was here in San Francisco. He knew that. Al had given him a schedule of the number 3 lot's pattern of appearances. They would get Al. It was the end of Duncan and Miller classic jugs. A sleek, modern auto cab called to him, "Can I help you, fella?"
"Yes,"
Ian Duncan gasped, and started out into traffic to meet it.
"This gives me a chance," he said to himself as the auto cab streaked for the destination he had given it. "But they'll get there first, or will they?"
The police would have to comb virtually the entire city, and block by block, whereas he knew and was heading for the exact spot where lot number 3 could be found. So perhaps he had a chance, a slim one, after all. "If they get you, Al," he said to himself, "it's the end of me, too. I can't go on alone. I'll join Colts or die, something dreadful like that. It doesn't matter what." The auto cab hurtled across town on its way to Looney Luke's Jalopy Jungle No. 3.